everybody. Welcome to Sapphic Culture Club, formerly Podcast of a Lady on Fire, where we explore lesbian themes in film, TV, books, music, and anywhere else sapphics roam. We are your hosts. I'm Laurel Hachinova.
And I am a roaming sapphic, Audrey Nee. I keep picturing bison, sapphic bison,
aww,
when you say that.
I love it.
Ooh, 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 ooh. Today we are going to be responding to some listener mail.
From ages ago.
From last season, it turns out. Mostly last season. I think we've gotten some mail since
then. Oh, that's true. Yeah, we do have some new stuff.
So most of this stuff is going to still be portrait related because we are formerly Podcast of Lady on Fire, as Laurel just mentioned. But now that we are a sapphic culture club, please feel free to ask us anything sapphic or not sapphic, but also continue to ask us portrait questions that we will attempt to answer.
Yeah, absolutely.
But if you want some love advice, romance advice, non-romance advice, lesbian career advice, lesbian hair advice, dykey animal adoption advice, we are here for you. We are very experienced lesbians.
Wait,
it depends on what I mean. I just meant like
very
life
gay
experience.
Yeah,
I don't mean like just lesbian experience.
We are lesbians with a lot of different experiences.
Yes, career advice, we've had it all. We've
oh,
had
man.
Careers.
This is if you were planning on asking us something before, you're probably feeling like maybe you shouldn't now that we've done this intro. Like, oh, I was going to ask them about career advice, and now I'm not so sure.
Podcast advice?
That's
we could
true.
Provide
hey.
Some of that.
Yeah. Are you thinking about starting a podcast? We would love to talk to you about that.
Yes.
It feels like a thing.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Just putting that out there. Yeah. We're also thinking about doing a hotline. I feel like, you know, be kind of cute
oh,
to have
yeah.
like listeners call in. And
sapphic hotline.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway.
So it doesn't exist yet. We're just saying that it might someday.
I mean, you could always send us like an audio recording of you asking a question, but maybe mm-hmm. at some point we will get like an 800 number or something. I have a traumatic 800 number story that I can share at some point. That's also gay.
Share it by the end of this episode.
Maybe. We'll see.
Okay.
Okay. So yeah, we got some questions.
The first one that we have is actually just a sort of an honorable mention, not really a question, but we got this one from Jude. So in the last season, we had been talking about, I would love to point you to what episode this is, but neither of us remembers. We were talking about the prizes that people could get for coming out, and Jude wrote in to point out that the 90s in-joke prize for coming out was a toaster oven, so thank you for that. That sounds familiar, too. Like, I feel like a microwave or toaster oven is kind of on my radar for that.
So the origin, as far as I know, and maybe there's something that goes further back, is Ellen.
Oh.
Her coming out episode that Laura Dern was in, who played her gay friend Susan, I'm trying to remember the specific details, but, like, Ellen has, like, a bad date with a dude or something. And then Laura Dern was like, I mean, Susan was like, I assumed you were gay. And then Ellen's like, oh, you're just like trying to recruit me. You know, gays always trying to recruit other gays, whatever. And then Laura Dern's like, oh, you caught me. I better, you know, report to like national headquarters or something like that. And like also bummer because if I had just recruited one more lesbian, like I would have gotten a toaster oven.
That's great.
I think I know what's going on is it's not enough for you to be gay. You know, you've got to recruit others, you know.
Hey, I'll have to call national headquarters and tell them I lost you. Damn, just one more and I would have gotten that toaster oven.
That's pretty good.
But then I think the best part is actually at the very end of the episode, during the credits, after Ellen does come out, Laura Dern brings her to this cafe where Melissa Etheridge is sitting at this table as sort of, I think she's supposed to play this like lesbian official. She sits her down next to Melissa Etheridge and Melissa Etheridge is like, okay, so are you gay? And then Ellen's like, yes, I am. Which, by the way, side note, that's the name of a Melissa Etheridge album. Anyway, lots of gay trivia for you today. So she says she's gay, and then Melissa Etheridge like hands her a stack of paper that she signs, and then Melissa Etheridge like dramatically stamps all the sheets of paper, and then hands Laura Dern a toaster oven.
That's so great.
It was like super cute, and
that's
like,
be
actually
a,
really funny.
A YouTube video somewhere, right?
Yes. Here's the audio.
Here she is.
Oh,
Okay, Miss Morgan, I have just one question for you. Are you gay?
Yes, yes, I am.
And sign right there. And initial here. And initial here.
Oh.
And sign here.
Wow, I didn't know it was so complicated.
Oh, congratulations. Susan, there's your toaster oven.
Oh, thank you so much.
Did you watch that show?
Awesome. I mean, I caught a few episodes, the way that you kind of catch everything that's on syndication.
Yeah.
But I had thought that this was in reference to, like, consolation prizes on game shows, which I guess it is, kind
it
of.
Is,
like, the
like,
joke
yeah.
is. But, that's yeah, the, I didn't realize.
Exactly.
That's cool. That's great.
Yeah. Yeah. Who knows? I mean, maybe there's, like, deeper toaster oven reference, but that's, I think that's the origin.
If you know of a different origin, please let us know.
So our next kind of question comment comes from Mary, who is responding to a previous episode where we talked about the sort of sparseness of portrait and like the minimalism. And so Mary says, I actually think the minimalism in costume and set, etc., was part of it being a memory, the bare bones and heart of the memory, nothing to distract. Only the essential was needed to tell of the memory.
I really love this comment.
Me too.
I hadn't thought about it before, and it's kind of like, if you've seen Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, there's this one point where the main character is having a dream and it's in a bookstore and all the book spines are white, you know, mm-hmm. like the way that your brain blurs things that are not the main focus of what you're, you know, what you're thinking about. And so I thought this was a really great observation.
Yes, same. As after I read this, I was like thinking about memory, my own memories, and yeah. I was like, oh, you're right, like everything,
yeah,
the only thing that's kind of in sharp focus is like what the focus is of the memory.
Yeah.
And I think in this case it's kind of like, of course it's, you know, Eloise and Marianne. It's interesting that they're wearing the most saturated colors, mm-hmm. as Taryn mentioned, like
that's
the last
true, yeah.
episode. So
yeah
I think it's this like really poetic way to speak to that without being like over the top where everything's like overly gray or like black and white, you know.
Yeah, yeah, like Michel Gondry literally made the books white, you know. So it's like, that was very straightforward, but I'm adopting this as my take on why this is so sparse from now on. So thank you very
yeah.
much, Mary.
Not the budget, but the but
right.
the memory.
Yeah, yeah. Did I say budget?
No.
Oh, okay.
I suspect part of the reason is, you know, the chateau
oh,
and
sure.
stuff was pretty sparse. And I mean, I think there are many reasons. I think it's like a stylistic sort of choice too, but I'm sure budget played a little bit into that, right?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Maybe. Because like also when she starts, when it flips from her remembering to present day, everything has more stuff in
that's
it,
true.
Right? So it's like
yeah.
the gallery, of course, has like so much stuff in it.
But that's still memory.
Her classroom. Kind of.
Right?
But she's
too,
like, she,
it's more
oh,
recent
this,
memory. You're right.
Or I don't know actually, because like, well, she did say
well,
like
she
I
says
did
like
see
when
her,
I see her one more time, yeah. But
yeah,
it could
yeah,
literally
yeah.
be like yesterday that she saw.
I yeah.
mean, so
yeah.
it's like more recent. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's less of a distant past.
Mm.
I think it's also a nice kind of. I like this theory, especially when paired with like the ghost being part of the her memory theory. So it's just it's kind of an expansion of this being Marianne's memory.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yay, Mary!
Great comment. Yeah.
Nicely done. Okay, so this one comes from Julie Cabral, who writes, although I hate to bring men into the conversation, I was wondering, are Marianne and Eloise's fathers both dead? Marianne seems to have basically taken over her father's practice, and I imagine that her coat is her father's and possibly her pipe, too. As for Eloise, the Countess seems to be the head of the household, organizing the marriage as well as hiring and paying Marianne. It could also add to why the Countess is so motivated to get her daughter, parentheses, daughters married off. If this is true, it could be another layer of the patriarchy being a sort of cage for Eloise while Marianne achieves a degree of independence from it. So this is interesting. I know we've talked about the dads before. The dads. The fathers.
They're fun. Daddies.
Oh, no. We've talked about their fathers before, but I don't remember explicitly talking about whether or not either of them was still alive. So as I was thinking about this question for this episode, I realized that I think Marianne's father is still alive, because in the gallery, the guy is like, oh, your father's in good form. And she doesn't say, oh, you know, well, and he uses present tense, right?
Yeah.
So and he, yeah. And then she doesn't say that he's dead, but, you know, maybe she wouldn't anyway. But then she just says, like, oh, no, it's mine. So I don't know. I think that, yeah, maybe she's practicing alongside her father and not necessarily in his place. And then for Eloise, I do think that her father has died.
It'd be funny if he was just kind of like hanging out the whole time.
Yeah, he's just
like
in
watching
the back.
TV on the couch or something. Yeah. Like a typical dad. Yeah, I had also assumed that Eloise's father is dead. I'm guessing divorce wasn't super common at the time, but it's pretty clear that like the mom is running everything and it's just the two of them in the house.
And that the mom wants to get back.
Right.
To Milan.
Right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So yeah. Marianne, I think it's implied that he's alive, at least in the beginning, because there's that scene where I think they're on the beach and Marianne says she doesn't have to marry and mm-hmm. she's going to take over her father's business, mm-hmm. right?
That's
which
yeah.
I feel implies, like, because she has not taken it over yet, that he's like still around. Mm-hmm. Also, like, they're relatively young. I realize lifespans are shorter then, but I'd imagine he's just in his, you know, maybe 50s at this point. And by the end of the movie, maybe he's like kind of elderly, but I'm making
or
a lot of 40s. Assumptions here.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's probably like 30.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yes, Eloise's father deceased, Marianne's father alive is cool. My assumption.
What do you think that it indicates about, so the last, sort of the last part of Julie's question, what does that indicate as patriarchy? It's kind of like an enclosing force in either of their lives? Because it seems like Marianne's life is definitely more expansive, right? Like, even though her father is still alive, it doesn't feel like the patriarchy is holding her down quite as much as, like, Eloise's fate mm-hmm. is sort of directed by it. So it's interesting that even though her father might not be alive, she seems to be the one that's more oppressed by it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that has more to do with their class and, like, their background, mm-hmm. more so than whether the father's alive or not alive. Because I think even if he were alive, she would still be oppressed, right? Like, Eloise specifically. Yeah. I think because Marianne was born into this more of, like, a trade, I guess, mm-hmm. than
yeah.
being born into, like, nobility, I guess. She has, in a sense, more freedom, which is interesting. And I think when they're having that conversation about how, like, you know, Eloise is going to get married off and Marianne can kind of do whatever she wants to a certain degree, that says all you need to know kind of about, like, how they're constrained within the patriarchy.
Yeah. I really wish Laura was here.
I know.
Because, like, I'm totally speculating, but I also feel like because Eloise's father is gone, she's more trapped because they don't have, like...
Oh, yeah. That's a good point.
A patriarchal figure. So it's like, this is her mother's attempt to leverage her daughters to get more of that patriarchal power back by marrying her off to another man.
Yeah, I mean, I'm guessing she's not going to have a lot of choice to begin with, but you're right. Like, I think the mother is in this state where she's, like, probably a little bit more desperate to
get
somewhere else. I think either way, it's going to be a certain cage. The mm-hmm. size of the cage may have expanded if the father was still alive, I guess.
Yeah.
This relates really well to the question about freedom.
Mm-hmm.
If you want
to talk
about
one.
That.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
So Beth asks us, is it free to be alone? I wish that was just the question right there. They say, I guess the question is answered in a few ways in the movie, but at first I didn't believe it. But upon my eighth-ish watch, I'm thinking it's true in a sad way. I think this is referencing this particular scene where Marianne says, your mother will let you go out alone tomorrow, you'll be free. And then Eloise responds, being free is being alone. And then Marianne's like, you don't think so? You don't think so? What do you think about this? Do you feel like freedom is being alone, Laurel?
Well, it's such a, I don't know, it's such a sad thought. But I can see where Marianne is coming from, because, like, being in this particular society, and probably society still, mm-hmm. there are all these expectations placed on you. And when you're apart from those expectations, it feels like you can do so much more and be more of yourself. So in that sense, yes. And then, of course, like, later when Eloise comes back, she says, in solitude, I felt the liberty that you spoke of, but I also felt your absence. So it's interesting, like, she's basically saying, yes, I agree in a way, you know, like, I felt free. I felt, you know, what you said freedom was like. But additionally, that solitude wasn't the be-all, end-all of the freedom that she wants. She points out that she would like to be with her, and it's really sweet. And maybe there's a kind of, a freedom that can be had outside of just solitude.
I kind of see it as, like, two coexisting feelings at that moment. I don't know if Marianne's presence in her life overlaps with the freedom, if that makes sense. Like, I think she can feel free but also feel, like, the longing or missing of someone, having her in her presence isn't necessarily like related at all to the freedom.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think especially for someone like Eloise, who I suspect hasn't been alone much, right? Like if she spent most of her life or most of her like adult life in the coven, she's probably mm-hmm. like always around.
Did you say the coven?
Did I say the coven?
I think you did.
Oh my God. Freudian slip.
What'd you say? I said you're such a witch.
It's either going to call me something else. I was like, wow, I did say coven. Okay, anyway, you can't spell convent without coven.
Coven, I know. So. We should explore this with Laura.
Let's. But anyway, I suspect she's mostly been around nuns. It sounds like she's never gone to listen to music by herself, like solo. And so when she was like, being free is being alone? I don't know. There was something so naive and innocent, you know, and wholesome about that question. But yeah, I totally agree with everything you said. It's very specific to this time. I mean, maybe not. I think it's specific to like women throughout time. You're all, you know, being constrained by these like societal expectations.
Yeah. I had two other thoughts about this scene while I was rewatching it. One is that, do you think that Eloise is... So when she said earlier in the scene where she's like, I felt the liberty you spoke of, she says, oh, are you leaving me tomorrow? Right. And she says it like totally cash, kind of like with this, you know, very nonchalant. Do you think that she's not feeling like 100 feels right now? Or is she like tamping all of it down to seem like she's being cool about it? Like, oh, no big deal. Or has it not reached that pitch yet?
I think maybe a little bit of both. Like, I think she is trying to be chill about it, but also, like, she might not be completely, like, it might not be in her consciousness completely. Mm-hmm. Like, I think the feelings might be there more subconsciously. And so somewhere in the middle of that.
Because when she says, I also felt your absence, it's like her eyes are kind of like lasers in a way, staring at the back of Marianne's head.
Oh, yeah. She's like... hitting on her, you
yeah,
know,
yeah, yeah.
with her face, her words. But she says, I think she says like, oh, you're leaving me already, right? Or like,
yeah, something
not
that,
like
yeah, yeah.
the next
yeah.
day, but like this moment in time because she just got there. And then meanwhile, Marianne's like, oh my God, my hand is covered in paint. I think the first time I watched it and since then, subsequent times, I've always thought like, oh, she's just being kind of like, well, yeah, like whatever. I don't care. It's cool. I'm an independent woman.
Yeah, okay,
now that
yeah.
I've tasted freedom, I'm like, you know.
Okay, the other thing that popped up for me when I was watching the scene is that she's come back from Mass. Marianne was like, how was it? You look very cheerful. Mm-hmm. And she was like, oh, I sang a lot. And I would love to hear Eloise / Adele sing a lot, like in this sort of, like a very cheerful Adele singing in this setting. It was such a cute sort of image.
Yeah, I'm having a hard time picturing what that might be. I don't know. Has she sung in anything that you've seen?
Not that I've seen, yeah.
Me either. We know Noemi Merlant can sing.
Mm-hmm. But even this character, like Eloise, just like super happy because she's singing. And she's singing a lot. Like she said she sang a lot. So, yeah.
like
it's like,
you
wow.
Might...
She wasn't
lot.
Just like, oh yeah, I sang, you know, I sang a little bit. It was like, no, I sang a lot. Was
you know,
line.
She was like belting it out too.
Yeah.
thrashing around.
Maybe kind of like off key. I don't know. so cute.
I think she was headbanging and like breakdancing. Yeah.
I don't know. We have very different
apparently
images.
You're like,
it's fine. Yeah, she looks more like a Muppet to me. You're like,
I feel like she throws her whole body into it. I think I'm having a hard time not mixing like Anel into the character.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Who
yeah.
probably the character yeah. would probably have like a little bit more poise in the situation. Anyway.
Okay. So this one, we got this question from Inside of Us, which is apropos because it's about the cave. So why do Eloise and Marianne hide in the cave to kiss? Was there someone who could see them? Does it have anything to do with the Greek mythology about the cave? I feel so embarrassed that I hadn't really thought, or maybe we have and I totally forgot, but like I hadn't related this to the Greek myth.
Yes,
at
you
all.
Have.
We have? Okay, great.
I think so.
Because, well, then I forgot again, and it felt like an epiphany.
We've recorded a lot of episodes. It's a lot to forget.
But, yes, so there is, in Greek mythology, especially related to the Orpheus and Eurydice myth, Charon's cave, and that is supposed to be the entrance to Hades. So it's interesting in the scene because they've, you know, they've come down the cliffs, they've walked across the beach, and then they let go of their hands. And Eloise goes forward into the cave first, right? So like in the myth, Eurydice is in Hades first, and then Orpheus comes to rescue her. So in the scene, Marianne comes to meet Eloise in the cave, and then they kiss, and then Eurydice, or Eloise, leaves. And in the myth, Eurydice, at least in Selene's retelling, says, like, maybe she was the one who made Orpheus turn around and parted them again. So I feel like, yeah, it's definitely a pretty strong parallel to the Greek myth.
Yes. And...
But then also, yeah, it's just super sapphic to be like intimate in a hole. So
wow.
Here we go.
Intimate in a hole. That is our new tagline. Sapphic Culture Club, intimate in a hole. One thing I'm curious about is, like, we know that the whole Eurydice and Orpheus metaphor was almost tacked onto this screenplay later.
Yeah.
I mean, it matches up too perfectly for it to not be related, I think. But I am wondering if it is just, like, a happy coincidence and that, like, the cave scene was written in before the metaphor came about. None of us have seen, like, iterations of the script, right? So I'm kind of curious, like, if it's possible that they aren't intentionally related. It seems unlikely, but what I'm wondering is, like, if Selene had already had that whole imagery in mind before the mythology metaphor.
Well, I assume that she would have wanted it to be somewhere secluded, right? And this wasn't going to be their first kiss initially.
That's true. Oh, yeah, that's a good point. I think on top of that, like, assuming that it's related to the metaphor, which that's totally possible and seems likely, I really think it was also, like, a stylistic decision. Mm. I think part of the question is, like, why... Or maybe I'm just adding this myself, but like, why was Eloise waiting there? Because they're kind of walking together. And then at one point, Eloise walks off and then she's just there, you know, and the camera kind of like tracks or like pans over and you see her. Mm-hmm. And I think A, it's for dramatic effect. And B, Selene has mentioned that 2001 Space Odyssey, the Stanley Kubrick film, is like a big influence on her. And there is a scene at the end that is very similar in terms of like shot. I mean, we've seen that shot by shot comparison. And so I think that was an opportunity for her to kind of pay homage to this film that she like clearly loves. So I think it's like kind of multi-layered reason for the cave.
Well, it's also interesting that the setting is interesting to me because one of the things I've always thought was a little weird about how this was all set up is that it comes right after the bonfire scene, right? Mm-hmm. Where it's like they've had this really big moment and then they just go home, I guess, then like sleep on it for a night and then wake up the next day, put on their like scarves, and then they go down the cliffs and then they kiss. And so it's like it feels like the first kiss IRL would have been at some point that the night before, like right after the bonfire somewhere. So it definitely feels very purposeful that it was one, the next day, two, on the beach, like outside, three, in a cave. It does feel like the parallels are really strong to the myth. Like even the Eloise going first feels very like Eurydice in Hades first. So yeah, I don't know. Like it feels like it almost feels like she did it to tie it to the myth more in my head.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's both. Yeah. I don't think there's any doubt. If you watch those two scenes, this scene and the one from 2001, it's hard to deny that they're very, very similar. And I think there's other parallels between the two films, which is really interesting. So yeah, I think it addresses two things.
Mm-hmm. But to answer the first question, was there someone who could see them? I mean, maybe. Like,
yeah. The seals.
Yeah. The homophobic seals.
No, all the seals are gay.
<That's true>.
Yeah, I think the cave thing, like you mentioned, to hide in a hole is very sapphic. I do think that was probably part of it too. Like they're obviously not going to be making out, you know, in the open. Although they're pretty like chill about it when they go back to the chateau.
Yeah,
they're like whatever. Like if Sophie knows MBD, but
that could be a class thing too, though.
That's very true. I don't know if there was anyone explicitly watching them, but it doesn't seem like there's that many people in this area.
Yeah, it seems like a pretty isolated area to begin with. But why
it's
not?
Like, to be ultra secure, let's hide in this hole. So to finish out our mailbag questions, a million years ago, we put out a call for Ask Us Anything. Maybe we'll do it again. Mm-hmm. We kind of did it in the beginning of this episode to get romance advice. Anyway. So this is not a portrait question, but this comes from Betty.
Warning, this is not a portrait question.
Trigger warning, this is not a portrait question. Everyone drops out now.
I know.
And Betty asks, if you could only have one for the rest of your life, fries or chips? includes all varieties. Thank you for adding that. I would have been like, wait.
I thought it was very important. Yeah.
I know. I think so too. Because if it was just like basic fries and basic chips, what would that even mean? So thanks for specifying.
Do we need to specify that like chips for us is not.
Oh, yeah. Because I guess that's redundant for some people. Like,
yeah. Or is it backwards? No. Because fries, fries exist in. Like, because chips are fries.
Chips are fries. But I don't know. Fries might mean something else.
Like Belgian. Yeah. So like if you picture a meal from McDonald's, you know, the thing that kind of comes with a hamburger that's made out of potatoes, we're calling those fries. Yes, only we call them fries.
It's this cute little thing we say.
If you go to a supermarket and you get a bag of like
Ruffles potato chips or Doritos, which may not exist outside. I think they exist in many places in weird flavors.
Yeah.
Not weird, but like interesting. Delicious flavors.
Good save.
Thanks. Those are chips. Those are what we are calling chips.
Yep. Okay. So I think.
This is hard. This is a hard question.
My instinctive clear answer was fries initially because I feel like I've enjoyed fries. When I think of questions like this or when I think of answers to questions like this, I try to think of like the best fries I've ever had and compare it to the best chips I've ever had. And the best fries I've ever had, I feel like, are far beyond the best potato chips that I've ever had.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Just because you can do a lot of things with fries, and if you fry them right, they're delicious, just like on their own. For chips, though, like I do have a very sort of strong nostalgia for, like, I love Doritos, and I can't help it. I find them delicious. Cool Ranch.
What's your answer?
I think my answer is still fries, though.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, French fries.
I kind of went through a similar journey as you, where my instinctive answer was fries. Fries are so great, and you can do like all sorts of things, like chili, cheese fries, dipping fries in ice cream, you know, garlic fries, garlic parmesan fries, sweet potato fries, taro fries, yuca fries, you know, forever.
Yeah.
You also get like a ton of variety with chips too. But then as I was thinking that, I was like, wait a second. I just impulsively ordered a 12-pack of family-size Utz chips. Utz is, if you're not a big chip connoisseur, is like an East Coast brand of chips. I think they're like from Hanover, Pennsylvania or something like that. And when I lived in Providence, I would have like easy access to them. But ever since moving back to the Bay Area, it's been hard to find Utz. And so when I found out on their website that they sell, you could just buy the chips, I was like, what? I like bought a family pack of 12. And then I also bought like an Utz, two Utz hats and like Utz socks and like an Utz mask and like Utz cup mug. And then it arrived. And why am I telling the story? I don't know. Sorry. It arrived. And one of the bag of chips was open. And I was like, oh, it probably just popped in shipping. But then I noticed that like the packaging also had this hole that looked like it was ripped open. So I was like, did someone from FedEx rip my bag and like take some chips and just like leave everything else? Like, why not take the whole chip bag? It's so strange. So typical of FedEx. Anyway, I don't hate FedEx. It's cool. Whatever. They're fine. What was I saying? Okay. So I wrote Utz and like I was like, hey, this happened. And they're like, oh my God, we're so sorry. We'll send you another bag. And then like 5 days later, another box of 12 chips. No, not yay.
Oh.
There's only two people in my household. We don't even eat junk food that often. I just like kind of impulsively ordered it. And Heather's like kind of obsessed with the South Carolina style barbecue chips. So I've been slowly bringing them.
I'll take some off your hands.
I know. I should have brought some over to you. We only have like a few bags left. This happened a few months ago. We've been going to a bunch of picnics. And so every time we go to a picnic.
Oh, that worked out really well then.
Yeah. We bring a couple bags. And so it's been nice. Yeah. So that was my long-winded way of saying that like, I don't know.
Okay. Well, which would you be sadder about never being able to eat again?
Probably fries.
Yeah.
Probably fries.
I think so too. Yeah.
There's just like all, I love like salted egg yolk chips from like, you know, Taiwan. And it's just.
Yeah, I know. Me too.
It's a huge
loss.
I like
the honey butter, like the Korean honey butter chips.
Yeah. There's all sorts of like. Yeah.
The corn chips. Asian corn chips are so good.
Yes. You know, I think the decision, I'm going to stick with fries because I think they like, there's something I consume like slightly more regularly when I'm having like, you know, a burger or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas chips are kind of like this.
And I can't imagine having a burger with like chips. It's just not, I don't know. It's not as satisfying.
Yeah. I'd be happy, but I wouldn't be as happy.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Who knew? That's this question. I was like, oh, this, we'll answer this in 2 seconds.
Yeah.
Well, there you have it. Now we need to know what everyone else would answer. Let's take a poll. I'm really curious. Yeah. And then we should also map it to see like if it's a regional thing.
Oh, interesting. We're not going to do that, but that's great.
No, we're going to do it. We're going to plot it.
We're not going to do that.
I'm glad that one of us is a little bit more realistic about our bandwidth.
All right, so now it is time for a new segment that we are trying out where we recommend queer things that we're watching or listening to or reading. We'll see if it sticks, but for this week, we've got a couple of recommendations for you. Audrey, would you like to go first?
Sure. I think some of our recommendations might overlap, but one of the things I've been watching is Generation on HBO. It's currently on season 2 already.
It's on the second half of season one.
I need to stop saying that. Yeah. They split it up after like episode 6 or 7 mm-hmm. or something like that. It's great. Even if you're not Gen Z or near Gen Z, I think it's worth checking out because I think there's like queer themes that, you know, will resonate with you regardless. And I'm not going to say too much because I don't want to spoil it. But I will also say stick with it because I think the first 2 or 3 episodes maybe might not be everyone's cup of tea. But I feel like the performances and the story gets really good and compelling and wonderful.
Yeah, I'll say that I avoided it because I thought, oh, great, another teen show where they try to force like queerness into the themes or plots. And so I was really, really pleasantly surprised when I think you encouraged me multiple times to see it. And so Allie and I finally watched it and we love it. And Allie was waiting for me to come back from my trip so that we could watch the rest of the season together, which we haven't finished yet because we're kind of spacing it out. But she ended up watching the first half of the first season again in the meantime, just because like we both enjoyed it so much and she wanted, I guess, a fix in the meantime.
Oh.
But I love that. I think for the first episode, I was sort of bracing myself for one of the queer characters to get teased or bullied in some way for being so outwardly queer. And it never happened. And it never does happen. And it's so cool.
Yeah.
Like, okay, I don't know. If you think this is a spoiler, we can cut it out. But like one of the main characters is very, very openly gay. And he's also on the swim team. And he's like a really popular person in high school. And I guess that's it. Like, I don't know if that's a spoiler, but like that is...
It's like MBD. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And they actually, like his swim team buddies are actually really cool with the fact that he's gay and kind of like joke around about it with him and really support him. So that was just a delightful surprise. Yeah. And it's written by someone who is actually like Zelda Barnes and her dad, I think Daniel Barnes. But she's like 19 and she started writing the series when she was 16. So I feel like it's pretty authentic. But she said that that character is based on someone in her school who was also super popular and very, very gay. Mm-hmm. But I love it. And I feel like I haven't seen that very often and I definitely don't see it enough. So yeah, also recommended from me.
Yeah, I think it directly addresses some of the criticisms that we've expressed about other queer film and TV, where it's like the conflict is everything is all about the fact that, you know, someone's gay or queer. Mm-hmm. And this just feels like the natural evolution. This feels like where we should be, you know?
Yeah. And there is a little bit of that, though. Like
there is,
the whole like
is.
Coming out and right. stuff and figuring out that you're gay or whatever, or, you know, queer in some way.
But it's not every character.
Yeah.
And, you know?
Yeah.
Watch it if you haven't.
Great. Oh, it's on HBO Max, so hopefully that's available to you.
I'm going to quickly go through some other ones that I've been watching and would recommend. I finished The Bisexual, which is, I think it was originally on BBC, and then now it's, I believe, on Hulu, but it's Desiree Akhavan's TV show, and there's only one season. I don't think it did very well, but I think it's so well done. I'm just, like, such a huge fan of Desiree Akhavan, and I watched that, and then I watched her first film, which was called Appropriate Behavior, which I also highly recommend. It's for a first film. It's like incredible. And I should have said this before, but Desiree Akhavan is the person who wrote and directed The Miseducation of Cameron
Post.
I was like Cameron Crowe.
That'd be an interesting one. You know.
Yeah. So yeah, highly recommend that. And then I just found out that the Seventh Row podcast also did a whole episode on Desiree Akhavan. So check that out too. Another queer adjacent show that I've been watching that it's not like great, but it's like a good diversion, totally serviceable, is Hacks.
Wow.
Hacks starring Gene Smart.
Yeah, yeah. Is it queer adjacent?
One of the characters is quite sapphic.
That's so funny.
I would say it's queer. It's, it's Jean Smart. I mean, she kind of carries the show. It's really good.
She's great.
I mean, she's really great. I feel like the show is like fine. But if you're looking for like sort of a distraction and you're like, you know, doing other things, like I think it's the kind of perfect show for that. One other thing I'll just throw out really quick is Loki. I've just been really enjoying like all the sort of MCU TV shows. I feel like they're so much better than the movies. Yeah, Loki is like, okay, it's not really queer. There's a little, like a little bit of queerness to it, but it's sort of, it's so well done. That is all I will say about that.
Yeah, that's interesting. Loki popped up in like another queer TV chat that I'm in, and I was surprised. I was like, oh, like I was instantly hoping that he was very gay, but I guess that's not the case.
Definitely not very gay, but he's not very gay, but you kind of have to watch. It's not a huge part of the show, but you know, I think there's also just kind of like a queerness to the show inherently, but
okay, cool. Yeah.
It's also just really beautiful. The design and like costumes and the set, it has this very like kind of mid-century feel. So check it out. And then one more thing, I guess, two more things really quick. sorry, I'm taking up a lot of time. This documentary, if you haven't seen it, called Dykes Camera Action, which examines lesbian representation in film, as well as the movies of lesbian directors and filmmakers. It was released in 2018 before Portrait, so there's no mention of Celine, unfortunately, but it is worth watching. I think if you listen to this podcast, you should watch it in the Venn diagram of like film and queerness, lesbianism, et cetera. Like it's kind of just a circle. And then the last thing I will leave you with before I hand it back to Laurel is Miley Cyrus. For Miley Cyrus fans out there, I'm doing it. She does this amazing cover of Metallica's song Nothing Else Matters, which is part of this whole, like, I think like a billion other artists are covering songs for the anniversary of their album, the Black Album, but her cover is so good. It's like so over the top, and I might like it better than the original song. Sorry for all you Metallica fans out there. Anyway, check it out.
I'm not sorry at all. Great.
That was a fake sorry. Okay, back to you, Laurel.
Okay, I had two book recommendations, one of which I will caveat by saying that I am just in the beginning of this one, so I can't say where it goes, but it's called The Tragedy of Heterosexuality by Jane Ward. And so far it's been really entertaining because I hadn't thought about how tragic straight culture is. I mean, like, I've joked around about it, but I don't think I'd ever sort of stop to think about how actually terrible it is, especially for straight women a lot of times. She also makes a distinction between straight culture and like straight relationships, because I do know people who are in what appear to be very healthy, wonderful straight relationships.
Do you?
I don't know anymore. Oh my gosh. but like straight culture largely is very rigid in its expectations, especially of women. And it enforces a power dynamic that is toxic, abusive in a lot of cases, and so pervasive that a lot of people don't realize kind of even what's happening at the time. I don't know what else to say about it. It's so sad. She actually points out this Instagram account called Hets Explain Yourself as just a sort of quick kind of like set of examples that, like, you know how straight culture is tragic even if you don't sort of consciously know. Because if you look at the posts in that Instagram, it's like one of the more recent ones is like a book of porn for mothers, which is just like men actually helping around the house.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
and it's like, it's that sort of thing. One of them is like his and hers coffee mugs that fit together, but the his mug is like full and like larger than her mug, which is just like this little crescent shape that fits around his mug.
Like a teacup that like goes inside.
Basically. So yeah, it's stuff like that. And it's like, wow, straight people out there, I am an ally. I'm so sorry. Like, I'm here to support your...
If you need someone to talk to, we're here for you.
Yeah. I haven't even gotten into the parts where it's like women relinquish their names, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, so we now have like generations of semi-nameless women in a sense. But yeah, anyway, so that's one of the things that I'm reading. Another queer book that I have read recently is I'll caveat this by saying Down with Capitalism. It's terrible and horrible, but it's About Damn Time, and it's by this woman named Arlen Hamilton. She is a Black lesbian woman who was homeless for a significant portion of her life, and when not homeless she was living near or below the poverty line, but is now a venture capitalist. So she's like, she runs her own venture firm, which invests in historically underrepresented communities. So people of color, largely Black business owners, queer people, that sort of thing. And she's done very well for herself in the scene. And so while I don't love very many things about Silicon Valley and capitalism, I do think that while we're in the system, it's good to have people who are trying to change it in significant ways. Yeah, so it was interesting to read her story, and she kind of peels back what being a VC is like. So I thought that was pretty informative and kind of inspiring.
Nice. We will link to all of these in the show notes.
And now it's time for this week's GASMR, which features Audrey flipping through the pages of the Plain Archive print edition of The Portrait of a Lady on Fire script.
But before we get to your enjoyment, do you have any sapphic questions for the next show? Oh, we're not burning anymore. Like, your UTI is cured. Great. Let us know. You can email us at sapphiccultureclub@gmail.com. You can also find us on Instagram at sapphiccultureclub and Twitter at sapphicpodcast. And here we go for some GASMR.
Enjoy.